This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Most of the stories about public schools these days are about guns, dropout rates, and falling test scores. Today on Fresh Air, a success story. My guest is Deborah Meyer, founder and co-director of the Central Park East Secondary School in East Harlem. Since the mid-70s, she's been applying her innovative ideas about learning to schools in New York City's 4th Public School District. In 1987, she received a MacArthur Award for her work. When she began to work in East Harlem, it was a district in disarray in one of the poorest parts of the city. Achievement levels were abysmal, absenteeism was high, violence and discipline problems were chronic, schools were deteriorating, and no one believed conditions could be changed. Meyer was part of a team of people who believed they could make a difference in East Harlem. They introduced school choice, developed their own curriculum, empowered the teachers, involved the parents, and the results are impressive. For example, in Meyer's high school, over 90% of the kids graduate and most go on to college. The story of Meyer School is part of a new book by Seymour Fliegel called Miracle in East Harlem. Fliegel was one of the forces behind the district's turnaround. I spoke with Deborah Meyer today about her thoughts on how children learn.
I think they mostly learn by joining the club of people who are more expert at them and what they need to learn to do. And they learn by observing, being shown, having opportunities to practice it out, getting feedback and correction. That's the way we mostly learn. We learn a foreign language by being immersed in it. And now it requires your imagining that you are going, that you could do that. You have to see yourself as a person, as the kind of person who could join that club. I often tell the story that my brother and I used to go to see baseball games all the time when we were children. And I learned a lot, as much as he did, about baseball. But he watched the game as a potential player. He saw himself as a baseball player. And he actually learned a lot about how to play baseball by watching it. And I didn't learn a thing about how to play it by watching it, because I never saw myself as the kind of person who might be a baseball player. When you read, you learn a lot. You mostly learn how to write by reading, but not if you don't imagine yourself as an author. But if you read with the eyes of an ear of an author, that's how you mostly learn to be a writer. And then you need feedback. You need an audience, an authentic response to it, which is what the teacher or other colleagues of yours can be to your writing. So you need an environment in which you can make mistakes, lots of mistakes, and in which you're not only not afraid to make mistakes, but that you take it for granted that people expect you to make mistakes and that they also expect that you're going to get to be good at it. Every novice adult, child, in short, is expected to grow up. You know, I have grandchildren now, some of whom are in diapers. We know they're going to get out of diapers, and not by shaming them or giving them grades or so forth. They're going to get out of diapers because they see around them people who aren't wearing diapers, and they too think that as they get older, they'll use the toilet.
Well,
that's nature.
If we were to walk through Central Park East Secondary School, what would we see? What would the school look like? What would it sound like?
Now, of course, I've been describing an elementary school, and I should tell you that we had an elementary school for 10 years before we thought we'd had not only one but three elementary schools in District 4 before we thought about the question of high schools. And because we figured it was hard to break traditions in elementary school, harder still in high school. And so in 1985, we had the courage to take the next big jump and think what would it be like if you designed a high school with the same thing in mind. And we designed our high school with a kindergarten teacher's mindset to make sure it was interesting. So if you went around there, you would see, first of all, adults who are talking with kids, talking with each other, kids who are talking with each other, kids who are working on computers and writing articles and looking up material and revising their work, who are in small committee meetings. You would see a conference table with 10, 15 kids sitting around it, reading the same book together, and an adult might be leading them in a seminar about that book and asking them to look more carefully at different passages. You would see sometimes kids in a more traditional lecture style where a teacher is demonstrating something or presenting some new material to them, and students are taking notes. You would see kids in laboratories working at experiments.
Would it look busier, even more chaotic than a typical public school?
It would look, if you weren't used to it, it would look, you might say, well, but where are they learning? And sometimes we have adults, we have tons of visitors, so there are some adults who are not accustomed to thinking about how we do learn as human beings. So we'll ask, well, where are they, when do they do the learning? But most adults coming in recognize immediately that this is learning activity, that this is hardworking students. In fact, one of the expressions of schools, we want the student to be the worker, not just the teacher. And in the average school setting, after kindergarten, that is, the teacher does all the work, or nine-tenths of the work, and the student is largely a passive recipient. The hardest activity is being done by the teacher. We want to reverse it. We want the hardest working activity, the most intellectually serious work, to be going on by the student. And the teacher is mostly the listener. They're trying to hear what it is the student still doesn't get. And then they're trying to devise a way to reorganize things so that, ask the right question or put the right piece of material in their hands or find the other student who might be able to prod this person to looking again at what they've done so that they might see where it really ought to be going.
I want to talk about the relationship between teacher and student. The way you've talked about some of your ideas of education, it seems that that's a very important relationship. What are you trying to promote?
Well, we think most learning is relationships. You know, human beings, as a human species, is very terrific at relationships. We're born into them, and we learn through, as I said, novices looking at it, more at experts. So the expert's job is to be a coach, if you want, to observe well and try to think about what about that performance needs improvement, and then to give the kind of feedback. You can think of it in a performing arts or sports model. I often think of sports models, but, you know, if you're watching someone dive, you can make a list of all the things they did wrong, and you know that they're going to get up there again and make the same dive. Or you can think about what would be the next thing I might mention to them. I might have them look at the way their feet are pointed. But you need to know a lot about diving to know, well, if I tell them to concentrate on this, will that change the way they enter the water? So you bring your expertise and understanding of the task to try to give them a picture of what they're doing and some suggestions about where they might take it next.
Do you have classrooms with children of mixed abilities, the quote-unquote
yes.
slow learners with the
yes.
medium and fast learners?
Yeah, and we have a wide range of ages in one class, so we're lucky to have at least two age groups together and a wide range of abilities.
Do slow learners slow others down?
You have to worry about that and think about that, so I won't say to you that that's not a risk, but when we know how to do it well, they not only don't slow down, but they are useful in the intellectual life of the classroom.
Describe that, because I'm feeling that's
well,
important.
Well, first of all, because frequently they have to talk out, though. If a kid who doesn't understand things, often clarifying it for that kid helps the kid who understood it fast but didn't understand it deeply. Who caught on, you know, this kind of superficial catching on. You always get the right answer. But the slower kid slows you down to stopping to think. You know, it's like being a teacher. When I taught kindergarten kids, things I realized I didn't really understand, but I knew how to do, or I knew how to give the right answer, but never thought about them. You know how little kids ask you a question. Why is this? And it elaborates and helps you understand something you never thought about before. Ooh, So what we call slow kids are often asking questions that irritate us precisely because the question is really, we skipped over that step, and we didn't stop to ask it. So they bring an intellectual contribution to the class. And the other reason is that the kid who's trying to answer their question has to be articulate. He has to try to think why he knows the answer. And in doing that, he learns a lot about his own thinking.
Do you see yourself then educating future workers, future thinkers? What about the three R's? And what kind of curriculum do you have?
I care a lot about the three R's. In the sense that I care that they have a lifetime of reading ahead of them. And therefore, when I say the three R's, I mean I want to make readers of them.
Mm-hmm. Readers, readers, readers.
Readers, readers, readers. Writers, writers, writers.
Mm-hmm. And arithmeticers.
People who know how to think abstractly and symbolic. Because those are very powerful tools, and people with power in society are people who are adept at that. And I want a society full of powerful people who know how to use their minds well. So my model, in a way, is to think about the powerful citizen. But I think we're more and more concluding that the kinds of qualities that make for powerful citizenship, in fact, also make for powerful employees and family members, and in the long run, collectively make for a powerful society. So we're kind of, in that sense, at a happy moment. It's not a happy moment in lots of ways in the world we're in, but we're in a happy moment in which we've concluded that it would be a good idea if more people in this world had the qualities that have always gone with the classiest of educations.
I'm speaking with educator Deborah Meyer. Her work in New York public schools is profiled in the book Miracle in East Harlem. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Deborah Meyer, founder and co-director of the Central Park East Secondary School in East Harlem. How do students get into the school?
Well, first of all, we have three elementary schools, and we fill half of our seventh grade by graduates of our elementary school, some of whom don't go on to other schools and some of whom stay with us. And the other half largely come from District 4 schools, which, as you know, is a district that has schools of choice. And so they select this as the school. And we try to keep a very heterogeneous mixed population so that while the school is overwhelmingly Black and Latino, we have some kids who are academically competent and some kids who are really still struggling with competence. We have 20% of the kids has what they're called special educational needs.
Do you accept every child who chooses the school?
No, but we accept them on the basis of a district system, which is first you go through the first choices and then we accept if we have more boys, let's just making it up, we have more boys than girls, we will just use a lottery to pick. They have to visit the school, though. They have to visit so that they know what they're getting into. In our high school, for example, you can't graduate our high school until you demonstrate in a fairly rigorous way that you have met our graduation standards. And I don't care how many English courses you pass, math courses. We don't do it by course credit. We do it by a agreed-upon school-wide set of standards for written work, for mathematical work, for performance in the outside world, and a whole series. We have 14 what we call portfolios a student has to demonstrate and then defend before a graduation committee, which includes faculty, students, and outsiders.
By being a choice school, do you get a more committed student body?
I don't think so, but I think once they're making a choice helps create a commitment. Kids, when they start off at the beginning of every year, the degree to which most kids believe of the possibility that they'll make it. It's always one of the touching qualities in all schools in the beginning of school year is that, you know, they've gone out and bought their new little books and they've got their pencils sharpened and they come into school. And there is a moment in which they're back to being like first graders and it usually goes away very fast. Like this year they're going to do their homework in time. This year they're going to be successful. So looking at the histories of the kids we get in our school, a great many of them have had 4, 5, 6, 7 years of nothing but defeat. And they come in that same hopeful way, and it isn't as easy. It's not a miracle. I think all of us who start schools, new schools, like all of us in District 4 who start our own schools, some part of us thought that if we could just do it our way, it would all be easy, and the kids would all be wonderful, and they would all do the homework on time, and they would all behave nicely, and we'd never have a discipline problem again. Central Park East is not Nirvana. Kids still behave badly sometimes. We still have to sometimes get sent to me, the principal, to deal with. I still have to call parents and say, what in the world are we going to do? Come in, we got to talk. There are kids who forget to do their homework day after day. And drive teachers crazy. I mean, all those things still happen. Kids bring a lifetime of bad habits and test us out all the time to see whether we're strong enough adults to put up with them and see that the work that they need to do is accomplished.
But does choice make a difference? And I would think,
yes.
As an outsider, that in a way, you're going to get students whose parents or who they themselves have thought about the kind of school they want to be involved in, have even perhaps thought about their
future. Every kid in our district has to make a choice.
Right. Because you have choice within the district.
Every sixth grader has to make a choice of a seventh grade school. So that is a help. But it's also true, I would say, schools of choice in New York City often got the kids who were the most troubled, to whom this was the most desperate measure. So, and I think of my own three children, which they just went to the local neighborhood school. But I had one kid who was the most troubled of my three. And he's now a teacher, a wonderful one, but he found going to school the hardest, and he found everything in life the hardest. And he's the one who began to think, maybe there's another place. We do the most convenient thing we can first, and if it doesn't work, then we worry about what else do we do next. And if there's no other alternatives, we turn off and get numb to it. I rarely have met a parent, and I've been working in poor neighborhoods for 25 years, and I know all the talk about how the parents are the problem. I have never met a parent who didn't deeply care, whom their children was not the most important thing in their life. But they become despairing if nothing they do is powerful or effective or useful, and then it's useful. It's not. They, like all of us, they get sort of numb to it and cynical and angry at the school, and they turn off the school. They don't see any reason to show up because they can't see any way in which their showing up will be helpful. We spend a lot of time in our school trying to think how to help parents be more powerful by our thinking about what messages we send. Do we send messages to parents that help them to do something more powerful, or do we just complain about the kid? It's no point in going to school and just hearing how bad your kid is.
Let me ask you another question about choice, whether you think that it is part of the solution of the problem of public education, whether it can be used prescriptively to deal with some of the problems of poor academic performance, of behavior problems, all the problems that all schools are dealing with these days.
I don't think choice by itself will solve anything whatsoever. I think, on the other hand, it's a very important tool to help us. And if you just say the schools are going to remain as they are and we'll give kids choices, and we'll give schools choices also about who they take, you'll have a tracking system among schools and nothing much will change. Big deal. And as always, the least powerful families will have the least choices. But if, on the other hand, what you're saying is, listen, we're going to create schools that have more autonomy. We're going to make schools smaller and more cohesive. We're going to give faculty also a choice about where they teach, and we're going to demand of them that they set standards and tell us what we should expect of them in their schools, and we're going to hold them to those standards. Then we're going to get a lot of schools that are very different from each other. And then we have to give parents choices. But if the schools are all more or less the same, except that some of them are better and some of them are worse, then it's not fair to give people a choice.
These schools are small. Do they cost more to educate the students?
There's disputes about whether they cost more or less. I think that they certainly don't cost less, and they could be run on the same amount of money. Since more money, we could use more money. I hesitate to say that.
Right.
but per graduate, they're a bargain. Mm. It's like saying, could we, I found a way to build an automobile much cheaper. Of course, the only thing is it doesn't run. We're not really counting the cost of American education in the way it needs to be counted. If we ask ourselves how many kids are graduating and how many of those who are graduating are well-educated, then the cost of American education is really quite a bit higher than we think it is. And then the cost of a good school is quite a bit lower than we think it is.
What, though, does money have to do with learning?
It produces the environment where you can have those kind of relationships. That's one thing.
Do you need a fancy environment?
You don't need, there's lots of things you don't need, but there are things that send messages. So if I hire you for a job and I have a toilet that doesn't work and I don't have any light and I make you trip over things, well, you can do your job. But I've sent a message probably of disrespect if down the hall they have all those things. So it's a dilemma, society. Lots of things could be done, and sometimes schools do amazing things in the most unbelievably deteriorating conditions. And I know a wonderful school that it's now moved called the Brooklyn New School. And the Brooklyn New School had one broken toilet for 200 kids. And it didn't have an office that was used the hallway, and the rooms were small, and it was the most wonderful place. But after 3 or 4 years, the staff and the parents began to feel like they were being abused. I don't know if you know. They felt taken advantage of. It was so much more work to make that place cheerful. And why was it being done to them? And since these were many kids who were in otherwise disadvantaged, it's like all of us. Why do we want a nicer home? Why do we want to fix up our garden? So is it necessary? No. But I think it's something we need to ask ourselves. Why does it seem important to do for some kids and not others?
I have one very quick question for you. School starts in a couple of weeks. Are there certain things you do to get ready?
Oh, yes.
You sharpen your pencils?
Oh, you fix your room. First of all, I do lots of talking. I mean, we with the staff in our schools all get back a few weeks early because we have tons of things we want to say to each other and talk about what we're going to do this year. Then we want to fix up our rooms, and we want to plan the day. We want to go over what the rules and regulations should be, and we want to look at the standards again, and we want to call a few kids in a little early, and there are a few parents we want to check things out with, and we want to make sure the books we have are the ones we wanted to have. And it's an exciting moment coming back together. And on this on Monday and Tuesday, we're all going to go away. Our whole staff is going to go away together to spend 2 days together to kind of remember what we're here for and talk about what we had in mind and look over our standards and our graduation and our governance system again and make sure it makes sense.
Well, have a good year, and thank you for joining us on Fresh Air.
Bye-bye, Marty.
Deborah Meyer is founder and co-director of the Central Park East Secondary School in East Harlem. Her work is part of a new book by Seymour Fliegel called Miracle in East Harlem. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.